name is Dan Robertson. I'm calling from Oakland, California. I've been tested 5 times. The soonest I got my results was in 2.5 days. The longest it took for me to get results was a week. I've been negative every time.
This is Julie from Erie, Colorado. I was tested in early March at an urgent care in Boulder, Colorado for COVID. I had to wait in my car for 4.5 hours. The nurse at the urgent care barely swabbed the inside of my nostril. I don't feel like the test was done correctly, but I can't confirm that.
My name is Kim Gilio from Sarasota, Florida. My son-in-law had the COVID test a couple weeks ago, and it was painful. Pretty much tried to suck out his brain. Anyway, that wasn't the worst part. The worst part, it was waiting 6 or 7 days before he got his results. That's just unacceptable. And by the way, they live with me. So what we had to do for those 6 or 7 days, put him on the other side of the house and completely stay away from him.
As the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases rises across much of the southern and western United States, testing remains a critical piece of state and federal efforts to slow the spread of the virus. But in many parts of the country, testing sites and labs are struggling to meet an increased demand, resulting in long lines in states like Texas, Florida, and California. Some people have had to wait hours in the sweltering summer heat to get tested, while others have been turned away entirely. And people aren't just seeing delays in waiting to get tested. It can take days, sometimes weeks, to get your results and to find out if you're positive for COVID-19. That slow turnaround might just undermine other efforts to stop the spread of the virus in the U.S., things like contact tracing and self-isolation of those who've been infected. I'm Tanzina Vega, and we're talking testing today on The Takeaway. Matthew Perrone is with me. He's a health reporter for the Associated Press. Matthew, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tanzina.
And Jennifer Nuzzo is on the line. She's the lead epidemiologist for the Johns Hopkins COVID-19 Testing Insights Initiative. Jennifer, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer, can you give us the national picture here? How would you characterize U.S. testing right now? Is there a strategy?
Well, unfortunately, there is not a strategy. We've made great progress despite that fact. We've really greatly increased the amount of tests that are being done in the United States from somewhere under 30,000 in mid-March to well over 600,000 in recent weeks. So this is important progress, but unfortunately, the spread of the virus has outpaced these efforts, and the amount of testing that the U.S. is doing is still not enough for the amount of infections that are likely out there, and certainly not enough to meet the demand for testing. So the absence of a strategy has really hindered this, because essentially we've left it up to 50 different states to figure out how best to address the testing needs, which in many instances has been slowed by global gaps in testing supplies.
Supplies and also labs themselves are backed up, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's really been interesting. We're hearing about a lot of different types of bottlenecks, but we haven't actually done a national audit of testing to understand exactly what the issues are. There's certainly been reports about shortages in the chemicals that they use to process the tests, shortages in pipettes, which is just another supply, and sometimes shortages in the swabs they use to take specimens. We've also heard that just labs just simply can't keep up with the volume, and that's possibly a personnel shortage. But we really need to do a national assessment to figure out exactly what the country's bottlenecks are and to figure out how best to address them.
Matthew, when we talk about testing, Jennifer mentioned some of the different kinds, but can you help us understand how many different types of tests are there right now?
For the vast, vast majority of people out there right now, there's really only one test that is going to matter to them. That's, as you said, the nasal swab. The scientific acronym is PCR, but it's really a genetic test. And that's so important because that's going to tell you whether you have an active infection right now, which is what most people want to know. The antibody tests are something different. That will tell you if you were exposed to the virus at some point in the past, if you fought it off, that's why your body made the antibodies. But I think it's important for people to understand that right now, we can't really do anything useful. The average person can't really do anything useful with that information. That's because we don't know yet whether having those antibodies makes you immune from COVID-19, whether it's going to prevent you from being reinfected, from infecting others. there are just more unknowns than knowns about antibody tests right now. So really what we need to concern ourselves with are those genetic tests, largely the nasal swabs.
And Matthew, there's been some talk also about at-home tests and rapid testing. Those are also testing for whether or not someone has COVID-19, not necessarily the antibodies, but are they useful and are they in large supply?
The FDA has authorized a handful of at-home tests, mostly saliva-based. You know, they basically send you a tube, you fill it with some saliva, you ship it back to a lab. They aren't available in large supplies. For a long time, they've been limited in some cases to healthcare providers. So they are a useful technology. I think everyone hopes that they'll become more widely available. But for the kind of, you know, mass testing that we need to do right now to address these long lines you're seeing across the country, unfortunately, at-home testing is not going to address that right now.
How accurate are these tests?
It really depends on which kind of test you get. And one of the challenges is that the performance of these tests hasn't been evaluated in operational use. So when companies that make them try to demonstrate their performance in order to get authorization to use them, they use basically lab specimens and compare the test results to what they know the lab specimens contain. But that's much different than when a specimen is obtained in operational settings where, you know, a healthcare provider puts a swab up your nose and tries to obtain a specimen and then ship that specimen off to a laboratory to perform the test. And so we don't really have a great sense of how these tests perform in real-world settings. That said, if you get a positive test result, you should believe that positive test result. There's potentially a larger problem with the test, and to what extent this is a problem likely depends on the technology, where you may get a negative that may not be a true negative. That could be just because you were tested too early, which is not really the fault of the test, but it could also just be that they didn't get a great specimen, or perhaps there was not enough sensitivity of the test that was being run.
Jennifer, what does it mean to be tested too early?
Yeah, so I think this is actually something that people don't expect when we talk about the importance of getting tested. Depending on where you are in your course of your illness, you could test today and be negative, but then test today and be positive. And it just may take more time for you to express enough virus for the test to pick it up. And this is, I think, important for people who may go out to get tested just to kind of see if they have it. That's not necessarily all you know if you test negative that day is that you don't have it that day, but you could very well become contagious the next day.
Interesting. Matthew, we talked a little bit about the long lines. We interviewed Mayor Kate Gallego yesterday about the long lines that she's seeing in Phoenix, Arizona, where people are just, in some instances, really being affected by the heat. There were some really strict criteria initially for people who wanted to get tested. And now I'm wondering if those criteria are still in place. I know here in New York, Matthew, we hear television ads all the time encouraging New Yorkers to get tested, but can anyone get tested?
Yeah, it really depends on where you are. And you're right. In the early days of the virus, of the outbreak, the CDC recommended from the top down that these tests should be reserved for people with symptoms, people in healthcare settings like hospitals and nursing homes, really trying to conserve the tests for the people that need them most. That's really changed now. We've realized a lot of the disease spread now is happening from younger people, people who may not even have symptoms, asymptomatic people. So what you're seeing is increased testing, broadening those guidelines to try and catch more of those people. You know, the downside is that we're going to have to test a much larger group of people. But we still have, as we've been talking about, many of the underlying bottlenecks and supply challenges that have been plaguing us since the earliest days of the virus. So it's as if, you know, we've built this bigger house, this testing infrastructure, but it's still trying to stand on these kind of shaky foundations of limited testing kits, limited testing chemicals, and limited personnel to perform the tests.
Matthew, how much do tests cost? Because again, in New York, we see advertisements for getting COVID-19 testing, and they say it's free. And yet I'm hearing from people who are saying it's not free. So is it free? Is it not free? Does it depend on where you get tested or what state you get tested?
Congress has passed a law under one of the pandemic stimulus bills that basically mandates that insurers cover testing. So by law, these are supposed to be covered by insurance. However, what you're seeing is that there can be ancillary costs when you go to get tested. They might have to run other tests. They might have to perform other types of care, and those won't necessarily be covered. So you do have these reports of people who went to get tested and are winding up with bills in the hundreds, sometimes even thousands, because they've been hit with these costs separate from the actual COVID-19 testing itself.
Jennifer, I want to go back to what you were saying about when someone gets tested. I mean, is there an optimal time for someone to decide when to get tested? Even because not only are we talking about waiting online, but the results that you get depending on when you get tested could be misleading. So what should people be thinking about if they want to go and get tested?
First, the most obvious time is that if you are feeling like you have symptoms, it's important to get tested as soon as possible, because you want to know if you have the virus so that you can take protective measures so that you don't infect others. It may not come back positive at that point, and it would be important to also talk to a healthcare provider to decide if a repeat test is necessary. Certainly, if you go to get tested because you think you have COVID-19, you should absolutely stay home and not interact with others until you get your test results, which with increasing testing delays may be a challenge, but it very much won't help if people just continue to go about their lives, potentially exposing others until they get those test results. But for people without symptoms, it's a little bit less clear. And this is one of the challenges as we think about expanding tests. Certainly, if you have been exposed to a known COVID-19 case, it is also important that you limit your interactions so that you don't potentially infect others in case you too have become infected. But you may go and be tested and be negative, but you shouldn't necessarily assume that that means you're in the clear. Increasingly, health authorities are encouraging people to stay at home, even with a negative test, for a certain number of days until we can be sure that people who have been identified as close contacts of COVID cases, that they can, you know, stay home for a period of time until we know for sure that they're not contagious.
Jennifer Nuzzo is the lead epidemiologist for the Johns Hopkins COVID-19 Testing Insights Initiative. And Matthew Perrone is a health reporter for the Associated Press. Matthew and Jennifer, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Pete from West Palm Beach, Florida, calling in regards to COVID. I tested positive on June 22nd. I had about 36 hours of symptoms, night sweats, chills, muscle aches, a little bit of a tightness in my chest. The symptoms went away. I feel pretty much back to normal now. So I still test positive last week. I have not been contacted for contact tracing, and I have not received a letter.
Always good to hear from our listeners on this. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. We'll be right back on The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.